Okay, so I just want to start, since I'm mostly going to talk about, as the title promises, sin, just a few opening comments. Many of you might know much more about Tolkien than I do. Working mostly with his letters, I just wanted to open by talking a little bit about what, in his own mind, he's doing with his literary oeuvre. According to Tolkien, in writing fantasy, he is trying to write truth. And he's writing truth in a way that accesses and stirs the moral imagination. Tolkien describes the Gospels as a kind of fairy story, which sounds very strange, but he says these are fairy stories because they contain marvels, and then they end with what he calls a eucatastrophe, okay, a sort of fantastic, unlooked-for event with an unexpected joyous turn. He says in his essay on fairy stories, "This story has entered history and the primary world," which by primary world he means our world. "The desire and aspiration of sub-creation has been raised to the fulfillment of creation. The birth of Christ is the eucatastrophe of man's history." So Tolkien is writing fairy stories. He prefers to call them myths, as I said, which are true. And he says, "All art must reflect and contain in solution elements of moral and religious truth or error, but not explicitly." He detests preachy writing. For this reason, he describes himself often not as inventing stories, but discovering stories. And they come to fruition precisely at the point where the link between the legendary and the historical and familiar comes to light. He says, "I'm just using the ancient device," and this is in another letter, "I'm using the ancient device of exemplifying a moral journey in unfamiliar characters precisely in order to make the moral journey compelling to the reader, restoring through the moral imagination a new and a clearer sight." This is a really important thing because you read about the Inklings and Charles Williams, and it's easy to imagine, you know, a man traumatized by the experience of war and just taking refuge from the darkness of modernity in an Oxford pub. He's like, "No, I'm writing because what I learned in the trenches is that humans have forgot to see things as they are. That's why I'm writing, to restore actual vision." This is beautiful. Back to the Gospels, though. Tolkien says that the Gospels are compelling in part because they have an inner consistency, a coherence that speaks to the reality of the human condition. For Tolkien, history itself is the story of the inner life of God, subcreated by humanity, and the relatively consistent, even repetitive character of human history suggests the reality of a human nature and a commonality of the human condition across times and places. For Tolkien, the birth and resurrection of Jesus Christ stands at the center of all history. This seems a bold claim, but it's the central thesis of my talk this evening, namely that the story of death and resurrection, instantiated in a story of hairy-footed hobbits and a ring of power, is indeed the story at the center of all human history. And somehow it is our story, because sin is real, and its reality necessitates heroic acts of victory over evil, making the courageous struggle of moral growth determinative of the drama of human life. So let's start with the Silmarillion set up how Tolkien sees this really just one story, and every great artist is just telling the same story over and over again. So starting with Tolkien's early narrative history, the center of its history is the making of the great stones, the Silmarils. So Fëanor is this great elvish artisan in his full might who considered how he might preserve imperishable the light of the ancient trees of Valinor, said to be the glory of the Blessed Realm. So Fëanor wished to take this beautiful music of creation that was embodied in the great trees and remake it according to the following criterion. Tolkien is very specific. Says that he writes that Fëanor had a new thought, and he had foreknowledge of some doom to come, and he, by a long and secret labor involving subtle skill, and he repeatedly emphasizes the secrecy of this work. And that was strategic, but it's interesting that he really leans on that. So the question should be asked, how can a divine language be captured, even remade, according to the secret and subtle skill of one artisan, with a clear intent to not only preserve, but to control something so as to meet the needs of one's present condition? Moreover, in alluding to limited but real foreknowledge, Tolkien suggests that this artisan is motivated fundamentally by fear. Here we have the first narrative instance of a fall in the history of elves and men. The three great rings of power would be made by the grandson of Feanor, and while both the stones and the rings are defensible as good in themselves, the possibility of tragedy is written into the very idea of capturing by art something which by its very nature transcends the order of nature. After the Silmarils are made, Tolkien writes that Feanor loved them inordinately. He became captured in his imagination, not by the beauty of what was not of his making, namely the light of the two trees, but rather he was enamored by his own craft and his own skill. This is a familiar story in traditional literature. But in this, the fundamental dynamic of sin is set in motion, beginning with the desire to possess, to covet something for oneself, however sympathetic the motives. The problem, in essence, the real problem is the primacy of the self. And as Augustine says in his Confessions, sin distorts creation by taking the highest goods, which by their very nature are common goods, and rendering them as private goods, okay, a bonum privatum. But in this story, there's a further motive element of not necessarily envy, but certainly vanity. Still, the fundamental issue of self-directedness is confirmed by the inevitable effect of the grasping, the breaking of friendship, discord and ties of kin and between different peoples, and finally between creatures and creator or creators. The effect of sin in the end is the opposite of friendship, and that is war. After Feanor's work is complete, he rebels against the Valar, who planted the trees in the first place. He claims the kingship and binds himself and his sons through a tragic oath to the Silmarils, crying out, "When we have conquered or regained the Silmarils, then we and we alone shall be lords of unsullied light and masters of the bliss and beauty of Arda." The tendency of sin to generate the discord of war is its most problematic dimension. And Tolkien understands this psychological event as the will to dominate, the libido dominandi. I find a reference to that in Augustine's City of God, and it doesn't correspond to the Latin text of 1 John 2:16, but it sounds very close to that biblical text. What I want to do now, just for the rest of the paper, rest of our time, is use those three criteria that Tolkien goes to pains to lay out step by step, the criteria of Feanor's own internal deliberation. I want to take each of these as elements of sin in turn and examine them in light of Tolkien's text and letters, and then propose appropriate counter virtues as redemptive corrections to those same sins. Now, in using the term virtue, I don't mean to suggest that Tolkien thinks that we can fix the problem of sin by our own effort. Rather, I mean, as Tolkien says, good literature is fundamentally about characters. And he uses every character in a way to tell a very rich, a very rich and individual story. Very clearly, this is best seen by the end of Lord of the Rings when the hobbits are sent back home. He's like, "Now take care of your stuff at home. He says, the whole journey has been for the sake of your moral growth, so you're ready now." And so every character in his or her own way embodies a cluster of virtues or vices, but one in particular that I'll focus on. Okay, so element number one is the element of knowledge misused. The first task of being a creature, as Tolkien says in his letters, is to be a creature, to live according to one's nature in regard to oneself and other living beings. Another way to say this, being a creature entails acceptance that one is not God, but has received being as a gift and the complex order of things as well as a gift. The first element of sin is willful deceit. In a letter that he wrote in 1954, Tolkien describes this in a fashion clearly reminiscent of Genesis 3, as involving concentration on some part of a story, inevitably leaving out other details or the big picture, as become discordant and thus irrelevant. And the allusion to Genesis 3 is deliberate there, because remember, according to Genesis 3, When Eve looks at the tree, she sees the fruit is good for food and pleasing to the eye. That seems correct. Moreover, the serpent really doesn't lie about the promise to know good or evil. Okay, I think this illustrates Tolkien's point because the falsehood lies in the loss of context. Everything else in that story that is fundamental, okay, and summed up by the one rule that's being abrogated. All right, but back to Fëanor. His failure is echoed later by the great men of Numenor in Tolkien's Legendarium, setting up for the dominance of Sauron over the fate of Middle-earth. The men of Numenor, like Adam and Eve, have only one law, a ban upon travel to the blessed realm of the Valar, the earthly haven of the immortal elves. And Tolkien makes clear that they do not and are not permitted to know the purpose of the ban. So like the one law for Adam and Eve, it can feel to the reader a little bit arbitrary. Fair enough. There is a purpose, but it only becomes clear later. You can read in the Akalabath that the gods wanted, it was to protect them. They did not want men to desire to overpass the limits set to their bliss. So we have to read on a little bit to make sense of what this means. Remarkably, at this period of time, the first generation of men, the Numenoreans, the Blessed Land is not far off, but somehow it's visible. But this is one of the errors at work in the mind of Numenoreans, because they think that that far-off land that everyone gets in a boat and sails off to at the end of Peter Jackson's films, they think that that is paradise. And the Valar are like, no, that is a haven, it is a resting place, it's a kind of purgatory. That's not immortality, though. And when the Numenoreans ask, why can we not get in our boats and travel there and live forever? The question is posed back to them, why would you think your nature would be any different just because you're in a different location? You're still mortal. As they order the brevity of mortal life by learning farming and skill with stone and metal, life in turn becomes more comfortable. As comfort increases, they forget the terror of the dark. They murmur in their hearts and ask for their envy to be rewarded. In response, they are told that the death they must suffer as mortals is not simply a punishment. Originally, death was a gift, and the purpose of this gift will be made clear someday. Once again, they are asked to trust what they do not understand. Quote, do not withhold the trust to which you are called. But it's too late with the murmuring in their heart, an opening has been made, and Sauron perceives this shadow and begins to make the nine rings that are intended to snare the human race. So even in this stage in Tolkien's history, knowledge is consistently presented as a gift, but it is always limited by its nature. Okay, that's an essential characteristic of creaturely knowing. So it's a good, but it's also an ambiguous good, because that's hard, especially for mortal men. To desire more than is appropriate always invites danger. Though we think of Gandalf, a wizard, as a purveyor of magic, when we read Lord of the Rings, we see the root of the word wizard, which is wise, consistently represented. Gandalf's majesty is generally described as veiled. He announces himself to Denethor, the steward of Gondor, as also being merely a steward. And to the folk of Rohan, he observes that he only comes when help is needed and for counsel. After the fall of Isengard, he deflects praise of the might of his wizardry, saying in response that, quote, if so, I have not shown my might yet. I have but given good counsel in peril, observing further to all assembled, your own valor has done more. We might best see the ambiguity of knowledge and the element of deceit and sin by contrasting Saruman and Denethor with Galadriel. Saruman reveals to Gandalf his secret knowledge of the purposes of Sauron through the medium of the Palantiri, the Seeing Stones. At best, Gandalf observed, these stones provide a partial knowledge, it is useful, but only gives small images of things far off and days remote. Precisely because this knowledge would be partial and thus hard to interpret, Saruman could not possibly be content. And in his searching without measure, of the Shire, or excuse me, I think I said Sauron, but I'm going to say Saruman. Saruman could not be content. In his searching without any measure or limit or hermeneutic to interpret, and especially in searching without sharing this with the shared wisdom of his council, inevitably Saruman was captured in his very gazing. Somewhat differently, Denethor keeps his possession of a seeing stone secret until the moment of his crazed demise, perhaps because he knows he cannot equal the skill and wisdom of a wizard. Still, he cries out in despair and shocking pride, and this is on your handout. "Pride and despair," he cried. "Didst thou think that the eyes of the White Tower were blind? Nay, I have seen more than thou knowest, gray fool, for thy hope is but ignorance. Go there and labor at healing. Go forth and fight vanity. For a little space you may triumph on the field for a day, but against the power that now arises there is no victory. To this city only the first finger of its hand has yet been stretched. All the east is moving, and even now the wind of thy hope cheats thee and wafts up onto in a fleet with black sails. The west has failed. It is time for all to depart who would not be slaves." Foolishly, Denethor can only imagine in this scene that Gandalf wants power in the same way that he does. And so he closes himself off to the council of the wise and comes to despair. By contrast, Galadriel, presented with somewhat more menace by Peter Jackson than I think the text warrants, knows that she plays a role in a larger narrative. Her time of greatness has long passed. She must know and provoke the members of the Fellowship to examine what, quote, evil they might bring along with the quest. She must also be tempted with the One Ring. Boromir suspects her as offering something to each which she promises she can give but truly cannot. However, she demurs and says, "No, I merely play a role of possible profit, of usefulness." She says, "I am not a counselor like Gandalf, but I offer some knowledge, no interpretation, just knowledge." And she warns in the granting of this knowledge that it will be very ambiguous and hard to interpret for that very reason. And so after Sam actually looks in the mirror and he sees the scene of the Shire being destroyed, she says, "You should not use this as a guide to determine action. Just hold up there, my son." She says, "The things that we do not want to see," I mean, it's a good question, why do they even look in the mirror? Okay. But I think there's a crucial sort of lesson here in how to use knowledge that is partial. Galadriel says that the things that we sometimes do not want to see or know can often be the most helpful. In a sense, her humility before her own gifts allows her to handle them lightly and generously. So, not surprisingly, the appropriate virtue that would oppose a proud and a grasping knowledge, a knowledge that would take apart as though it were the whole or as a rule for action, the appropriate virtue is humility to oppose this. In a crucial letter, number 144, Tolkien says that knowledge is only used well by those who have taken a kind of vow of poverty. In this, one renounces control utterly, taking delight in things without reference to oneself. I think this quotation is on your sheet, I think. Watching, observing, to some extent knowing. Tolkien describes this knowledge further on as a kind of contemplative and receptive knowledge, and also a praise-generating knowledge, free from the taint of grasping and seeking power. A second and related aspect of humble knowledge is a willingness to keep contemplative knowledge separate and distinct from practical knowledge, or the simple decision to act. Echoing a famous saying from J. Robert Oppenheimer, Tolkien, in a different letter, denounces the mindset of the modern scientific mind. If a thing can be done, it must be done. Tolkien, I would summarize as just the opposite. Don't do anything, or at least do something really slowly, as ent-like as possible. And at one point in the same letter, he says, "But the evidence of true freedom and the greatest examples of the action of spirit and of reason are in abnegation." Self-denial. Interesting. It's no surprise that for Tolkien, hobbits play the central role that they do, precisely because they really are stewards by nature. They're gardeners. they cultivate creation, they beautify it, and at the end of the day, they care for little more than a well-weeded garden and a good smoke. In the prologue to The Lord of the Rings, we learn that hobbits received more than one skill from the elves, but upon learning that three towers remained in their country, which made possible some view of that distant earthly paradise across the seas, they promptly decided to not bother climbing any one of them because they were generally suspicious of water. In general, hobbits are described as, yes, it's a bit paternalistic and provincial, but they are described as hardworking, contented, moderate, and very generous. Remember, birthday parties, they give everyone a present. They are not childlike, except in that they are strongly ordered to pleasure. But it's not an indulgent pleasure. It is a, I would argue, a contemplative Sabbath-like pleasure. Okay, two shorter sections. The second element of sin is, if the first one is knowledge misuse, the second element is the will misuse, by which I mean us to understand fear. All right, so then back to the Numenoreans. Over time, not only do they grow forgetful of the terror of the dark, as I said, Tolkien also says that they grow weak and fearful. Fear is a powerful and crippling emotion. We might observe that our Lord in the Gospel says more often than anything else, be not afraid. The opposing virtue to fear is faith or trust. And radical trust is closely bound up with what I've just discussed, the first element of sin, namely the acceptance or non-acceptance of being a creature. Trust is challenging, and it assumes that one has a trustworthy partner in the relationship. When Adam and Eve reject the law of God, they reject much more than the law. They reject fundamentally the identity and the goodness of God. Closely aligned to trust is the virtue of courage. The final parts of Return of the King, agonizing on the whole, describe the remarkable endurance of Sam and Frodo as they cross the dark territory of Mordor and approach Mount Doom, bereft of water or any other comfort. Such endurance would not be possible were not their faith vested so powerfully in the wisdom of the original council held in Rivendell. Trust draws extraordinary resources from simple hobbits, confirmed by the repeated appeals made as they cross the plain to the light of Lady Galadriel or the light of Lorien and to the wise counsel of Gandalf. In particular, the fidelity of Samwise is clearly the central force bringing the quest to a successful end. But first, to consider fear more particularly, Tolkien says that his story, and the only true story, is that of sin and redemption. The concrete temptation for all embodied creatures is the struggle with time or with death and immortality. If the last section of my talk argues for the element of deceit and sin precisely through rejecting creatureliness, this part argues that the fear of death and the attendant refusal of the nature of time is yet another form of rejecting creatureliness. Compare the situation of elves and men by the time of the events of Lord of the Rings. So elves are immortal. They're not eternal. Tolkien is quite clear. We know they can be killed and they reproduce. Not much, but they do. At their best, elves are consummate artists. They're close to nature. Hence, Sam observes while they're walking around Lorien. They seem to belong here more even than hobbits do in the Shire. Whether they've made the land or the land's made them, it's hard to say. They also glorify nature through art. Galadriel observes that the concept of magic as articulated by their guests doesn't really make sense to them, confirming Tolkien's theology of the miraculous as a special revelation of the way that nature is actually supposed to be. And this seems to be the purpose of elvish art. It is revelatory. The phial of Galadriel that Sam and Frodo carry captures the light of their beloved star by a mechanism that avoids the fear and pride of Fëanor's stones. And this is an obvious example to me of how their role is to share and to reveal. From another perspective, however, the immortal elves are fading. They're tired. Their art, Tolkien says, is shot through with nostalgia. At worst, as he writes in one letter, Tolkien says that elves are embalmers. The joy of the elves is to pass away from historical time when their time has come, refusing any temptation to halt time or to master time through illusions of power. Tolkien's prehistory implies that death is something envied by immortal elves precisely because they know, as men do not, that it is a gift of gods, which frees humans from bondage to the circles of the world, as he calls them. The longing for immortality on the part of men, on the other hand, can only be for something false, leading, as Tolkien says, I love this phrase, leading the small to a golem and the great to a ringwraith. While the longer lifespan of the Dunedain might seem enviable, the sad fate that accompanies the gift of modestly extended life is clear. The men of Gondor, begrudging their mortality, no longer have children, but instead build more and more glorious tombs, fabricating the cult of the dead, and hoarding wealth rather than enjoying the immediacy of present blessings. Tolkien says the reward of long life is the very means of temptation. They have time for wisdom and achievements, but the experience of this makes humans simply desire more time, more glory. But the building of tombs and the refusal to have children are surely expressions of a deep and abiding fear of death. The character of Aragorn counters this tendency with a willing acceptance of the idea that he has a role to play in a larger drama and that he must be faithful to his name and his heritage. As soon as the victorious battle is ended in Return of the King, and the hobbits are anxiously asking, why doesn't he just declare himself king? We all know what's going to happen. We find that Aragorn is actually already preparing for his death. He's preparing for his succession. To the hobbits, Gandalf says, and this is on your handout, many folk like to know beforehand what is set on the table, but those who have labored to prepare the feast like to keep their secret, for wonder makes the words of praise louder, and Aragorn himself waits for a sign. I love it. At this point, Mary says, I thought you guys said he wasn't talking in riddles anymore. Okay. It's an enigmatic passage, but it's at the very least, it's clear that Aragorn is not the one who labors. He is the one who is waiting with deep trust for the will of some larger sense of providence to become clear to him. At the same passage on your handout, Gandalf then turns to Aragorn in council, and he says, this is your realm and the heart of the greater realm that shall be. The third age of the world is ended, and the new age has begun, and it is your task to order its beginning and to preserve what must be preserved. For though much has been saved, much must now pass away. And then, of course, in about three paragraphs, he gets married and he's good to go. But he's preparing him for a task of stewardship and an act of preservation, but also of letting go. The fear that is understandably associated with the limits of mortality is itself a profound temptation, if not an essential element of the sin that puts man at war with his own nature and with the gods. Turning to the next and final part of my talk, in which Sam figures centrally, it could be said that Sam is not only, I mean, it should be said, it is by Tolkien, not only is he the true hero of Lord of the Rings, but the best embodiment of the fidelity that opposes our tendency to fearfulness. Fidelity to a task that is far beyond his natural capacity, and fidelity to his part in a story in which he has, quote, lots of chances of turning back, only he doesn't. So element three is sin in action, or what I referred to earlier as the libido dominandi, the will to power. All right, so if refusal of creatureliness through will deceit is the first element of sin, and fear the second element and basic psychological motivator of sin, then the full evidence of sin for Tolkien is the will to dominate. Alluding again to Genesis 3, it is worth noting, this is my allusion now, it is worth noting that the human vocation, what Tolkien calls the role of a sub-creator, is basically one of dominion, which, as you know, dominion has the root dominus, lord, okay, of being godlike within the natural order. This rule precludes grasping at things as private goods most strongly by being ordered, by the rule being ordered to the essentially divine activity of Sabbath contemplation. You can't grasp what is there. Dominion is disfigured to become domination. Thus, in Genesis 3, the offspring of Eve will crush the head of the serpent, husband will domineer over wife, and man will be dominated by his destiny of finitude and death. The One Ring symbolizes the will to dominate in its capturing of some good, objectifying it, even technologically, and Tolkien has a lot to say about technology, which I'm avoiding. It's a very interesting other thing we can discuss if you want. And then utilizing this captured, objectified good as a tool to subjugate others. This isn't, he has no doubt there are just some tools that are evil, no question. Like the Silmarils, the ring is the false promise of objective physical force. It is also, Tolkien says, an allegory of, quote, the inevitable fate that waits for all attempts to defeat power, that waits for all attempts to defeat power by power. The character Saruman may illustrate this phenomenon best. He begins with a laudable desire for knowledge, then he is hasty to come to conclusions about the state of affairs based on partial knowledge. He doesn't seek counsel. Then, out of fear and his secret, he seeks to know more. And in the fearfulness and secrecy, he's given over to evil. And then when he opens himself up to Gandalf, we learn, and this is the long quotation on your handout, a new power is rising. This is Saruman speaking to Gandalf, as reported at the council. Against the new power, the old allies and policies will not avail us at all. There is no hope left in elves or dying Numenor. This, then, is one choice before you, before us. We may join with that power. It would be wise, Gandalf. There is hope that way. Its victory is at hand, and there will be rich reward for those that aided it. As the power grows, its proved friends will also grow, and the wise, such as you and I, may with patience come at last to direct its courses, to control it. We can bide our time, we can keep our thoughts in our hearts, deploring maybe evils done by the way, but approving the high and ultimate purpose, knowledge, rule, order, all the things that we have so far striven in vain to accomplish, hindered rather than helped by our weak and idle friends. There need not be, there would not be, any real change in our designs, only our means. Augustine critiques the Roman notion of the will to power as, in essence, being a commitment to, first, seeking the finality of human good in earthly institutions or through political solutions, and two, as the concept of attaining something like peace through aggression and war. He rejects both of these in the City of God. By contrast to the will to power, says Augustine, and its attendant vices of excess, a lack of moderation, sobriety, temperance, and piety, against these, Augustine says, true peace can only be found in the good of community that is bound together by charity. By contrast, the key ideas in Saruman's appeal, power, reward, control, acceptance of necessary evils, any means, so long as the end is attained, knowledge, rule, order. By contrast to the acceptance of natural order appropriate to creatures, here we have the imposition of an order that arises from a finite creature who has made himself a lord. Tolkien admits that his rejection of this aspect of sin, this will to domination, is a basically pacifist model of justice. He was called that as a kind of slander. He's like, fine, I'm a pacifist. I'm not naive, though. He said, the more persons and nations that commit themselves to the logic of defeat of power by power, the more they lose sight of the real order of things. The only possible virtue to counter this element of sin will be one that shocks our instinctive sense of justice, and that is mercy. Recall the mercy of Bilbo, appealed to by Gandalf when Frodo says how much he wished that Bilbo had killed Gollum when he had the chance. Frodo himself takes up this mercy, identifying with Gollum more and more deeply as he approaches Mordor, developing within himself a capacity for compassion and understanding his own suffering through his personal suffering. Samwise's great moral failure, says Tolkien, is his hardness of heart toward Gollum. In letter 246, Tolkien says the most tragic moment for Sam is when Gollum's countenance is transformed while watching Frodo sleep, and Peter Jackson actually captured this scene nicely. Gollum is watching Frodo sleep and his face just sort of softens. He's like, nice master. And Sam looks at Frodo and sees Gollum from behind as Jackson renders it, but he doesn't see Gollum's face and he just like comes up. I don't think he's kicking him in this scene, but he does yell at him, and, And he, in the book, it says that he kicked him away, and Gollum replies, "Nothing, nothing." All the humanity that the mercy or pity of Frodo, that the mercy and pity of Frodo brings out of Gollum at that moment is lost. You know that reading the book and watching these films. Still, by the end, Sam makes the crucial move of overcoming a totally understandable desire for vengeance immediately after Gollum betrays him to Shelob, leading to what he takes to be Frodo's death. Right, so he's wrapped up on the ground. He's like, "What am I going to do?" This is one of the lines. It might be the last long quotation, or the second last one on your sheet. Tolkien writes, "He knelt and held Frodo's hand and could not release it. As time went by, and still he knelt, holding his master's hand, and in his heart keeping a debate. Now he tried to find the strength to tear himself away and go on a lonely journey for vengeance. If once he could go, his anger would bear him down all the roads of the world pursuing until he had him at last, Gollum. Then Gollum would die in a corner. But that was not what he had set out to do. It would not be worthwhile to leave his master for that. It would not bring him back. Nothing would. He looked on the bright point of the sword. He thought of the places behind where there was a black brink and an empty fall into nothingness. There was no escape that way. That was to do nothing, not even to grieve. And that was not what he had set out to do. What am I to do then?" he cried again. And now he seemed plainly to know the hard answer. See it through. So he contemplates vengeance, and he should be. And it's gone. In a letter, Tolkien says that the power of mercy is a, quote, "truly delegated gift from God." For Tolkien, the gospel demands for forgiveness. The gospel demand for forgiveness opens the possibility, he says, that somebody might steal something from me, and nevertheless, I might have to consider it as a gift anyway. He says, if the creature receives creation, especially his own, as a gift, perhaps mercy is not the exception, but merely a delegated recognition of what of the fact that we have all received what we have from God. In the end, Tolkien says, the story of human history is indeed one of fall, because evil is real, but also one of redemption, because mercy intervenes as an undeserved eucatastrophe to save the whole class. Pity and the forgiveness of injury, he says, have a supreme value and supreme efficacy. Because Sam, in the end, has mercy on Gollum and just can't, even right before the Mount Doom, he just says, "Just get off," and he no longer even cares about killing him, ending his life. Because Sam does not kill Gollum at that last moment, Gollum then can enter in and be the necessary agent in the destruction of the ring, which proves just too powerful for Frodo to resist in the end. Tolkien is very clear that in this sense, Frodo fails. What can the guy do, right? But I cited Augustine at the start of this last section, who speaks not only of mercy, but of charity, the bond of peace, infinitely valuable. So where discord is clearly at work within the fellowship of the ring, the love of friendship responds by healing discord. And we see this happening. There's just so many instances in Lord of the Rings. But we see a first very clear example of the breaking apart of the fellowship in Boromir's confrontation with Frodo, to which Frodo responds, "My heart warns me against trust in the strength and truth of men." This failure, however, is mitigated by Sam stubbornly following Frodo, and later by Faramir's willingness to trust the counsel of wise persons, which willingness Sam describes as, quote, "the gift of friendship unlooked for." The quest is endangered near the end by Sam's temptation by the ring, which recedes in the hour of trial, Tolkien writes, due to the love of his master holding him firm. In sum, and to explain why, for Tolkien, Sam, in the end, is the true hero of the story, we see these three essential virtues that correct the three elements of sin as I've laid them out: humility, trust or fidelity, and mercy, or better, charity. We see these three virtues summed up in the privileged vision that Sam has of the grace and providence that is moving the whole story of historical life, shared with the reader from the dusty, dark plains of Mordor. And this is your last quotation. It's a beautiful passage. And you will know this. This is at the moment of, like, the darkest despair. on the plane of mortar. And Sam, Frodo, I think, is asleep in his lap, and Sam looks up to the sky and says, "There, peeping among the cloud rack above a dark..." there was a problem with my scan there. I'm just trying to guess what that word is. It's not T-O-R. Peeping among the cloud rack above a dark... Sorry? I guess so. I think they're further... I thought they were farther away from the tower. I like that, though. High up in the mountains, Sam saw a white star twinkle for a while. The beauty of it smote his heart, and he looked up out of the forsaken land, and hope returned to him. For like a shaft, clear and cold, the thought pierced him that in the end, the shadow was only a small and passing thing. There was light and high beauty forever beyond its reach. His song in the tower had been defiance rather than hope, for then he was thinking of himself. Now, for a moment, his own fate and even his master's ceased to trouble him. Thank you.